Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, it's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Sweet Home, Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. Just to let you know that we make no money on the radio show, we make no money on the website. So when we have these acknowledgments, Recovery Today gives us some print space, and WNAH at a Nashville does this as a public service. They believe in what we're doing. We believe in what we're doing, and we hope you believe in what we're doing. We're going to make you a believer. I'd like to acknowledge my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist and does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe that families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation, so does the country, so does the world. We've also found that if children are taught correct principles, they can teach themselves. But not getting those principles, they end up growing up latchkey kids, empty lot weeds, the gangs, the clubs, the groups, and they teach, and that's how they find out about life. And, of course, drugs, sex, and rock and roll is a big part of that peer group pressure. You notice a lot of the young folks today are filled up with tattoos and holes in their body. You know, that's the style right now, and it's kind of like, now as an older person, it's kind of like, wow, what are they thinking? You know, when they're like 80 years old and the skin is hanging, I wonder what it's going to look like at that point. But it's a fad that will be a permanent fashion to them. They have there's billboards here in Houston. It says Dr. Tadoff, where the doctor goes, I guess, with laser or something and able to remove some of the tattoo. So I thought maybe it had reached the pinnacle of acceptance, and so I tell the kids in my group, I says, you know, maybe you should think about selling short and get rid of some of those tattoos. We had one lady in there, one young lady, and she looked beautiful girl, and she's just filled with tattoos, and I really distracted from her beauty. And what she said was every time she was thinking about drinking or drugging, what she would do would get another tattoo. And tattoos are painful. I've had one when I was in the military. I did a military. I was going to Vietnam, and it was a warrior thing, and, you know, so that kind of deal. So I get the drift, but they're very painful to put on. But that pain distracted her from having another drink or drug, and that's what she did. If you're familiar with any of this phenomenon, they're called cutters. There's people who are in such emotional pain that they cut themselves. And the physical act of cutting themselves direct the physical pain away from the mental, emotional, and spiritual pain that they live. So it's quite a convoluted phenomenon. How you doing tonight, Carol?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Joseph. It's nice to be on the radio again. And this, folks, this is our way of giving back. Joseph doesn't make a penny on the radio show or the website. In fact, he's invested thousands of dollars establishing them and maintaining them. But that's his way of giving back, and appearing on the show is my way of giving back. We have a wonderful guest tonight. If you'd like to call in and participate, the number is 949-534-0621. That's 949-534-0621. So it's nice to be here. It's nice to be in recovery. I really appreciate the 12-step programs. I've participated in several, and the one I participate in now is called Celebrate Recovery. It's the 12 steps, and the scriptures have been reconnected the way they were back in the 1930s, and Jesus Christ is right at the center of it the way it was back originally. So I enjoy celebrating recovery. So that's enough out of me. Back to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. Oh, by the way, I got to speak. I was a keynote speaker at the North Shore Group out in Channelview here in Houston. It's about, I guess, about 45 minutes away. They had me speak on social media and the AA and the Internet. It was very interesting. Yeah, it was good. It was good. I was able to promote Rum Radio and some of the groups and the understandings of social media and how AA worked. I got to read Bill W.'s original, his last speech, which was real interesting. And in that speech, he talks about anonymity is the key to long-term AA development and change. He says, AA will change. AA must change. So I believe that's part of the change is the Internet. What we're doing is part of the change in Rum Radio. We're able to go out to places on the Internet that would have otherwise been impossible to do. We're all over the world in different pockets. What were we going to say, Harold?
I was saying that's right. It's incredible how wide the reach is now because of Internet.
Yeah, we're popular in Nepal. You know why we're popular in Nepal?
Why is that?
They like our yak. That would have been impossible several years ago. Matter of fact, I'll tell you something that's real interesting. When I started Rum Radio, it's about 4 years, 10 months ago, when I put together the website. And I was sending it out, as best as I could. I wasn't even on with the social media. I was just sending it out different ways that I could figure out to get the word out and to different countries and different languages. And that was just at the time when the Internet came up with interpretations. They had algorithms or logarithms, I don't know which one it is, but a mathematical sequence that takes languages and puts the language into the language of the person looking at it. So if I'm writing to someone in Polish, in Poland, and they don't speak English, it comes to them in Polish. Now, I didn't know that at the time that started, but we started exactly just almost at the same time, that phenomena started when we started sending this stuff out around the world. So it's like the Tower of Babel, where you send this out, send it to Mexico. Well, when they get it in Mexico, they hit a button, and it translates it from English to Spanish. In Portugal, the same way. In England, Winston Churchill said, "We are peoples with the same legends and the same culture, separated by a common language." So this is quite the phenomenon that it's been out in the world in different languages, and people from Ecuador and India, you know, all over the globe, China, Japan, any place where it's an open access to the internet, have been able to get onto this recovery information. I think that's amazing. It's marvelous. I really believe it's a God deal. The timing was couldn't have been more perfect. It's still a trudge. You know, you're not going to get everybody. It's a very spiritual, highly spiritual site. I stick to the principles of AA. I tell my church this. I've been trying to get AA under their roof, and I belong to a conservative church. They have their own 12-step program. So I went right to the top of the food chain and worked my way down. I'm that kind of guy. I always said there's a Hebrew saying, you should talk to the head and not to the ass. So I went right to the top. I spoke to them, and I wrote to them. They wrote back, as a matter of fact, which is unusual. They wrote back to me, and basically they're not going for it because they have Jesus and Heavenly Father, and they don't want to do the higher power shtick. They can't get over that hump. So I said, well, if the 12 steps are not a gift from God, why have you adopted them? And if they are a gift from God, why do you feel compelled to change them? I never get an answer from those queries, but that's the way I believe should work. I've seen people come in that were atheists and agnostics, and eventually they've grown into higher spiritual states of understanding, getting the God of their fathers. But sometimes it's like spiritual kindergarten. You have to start them off slow. You got to take them by the hand and go, okay, a lot of folks are at war with God. They don't want to talk to him. I came in. We weren't on talking terms. And eventually I got back to the God of my fathers. Because of AA, because of AA spiritual, as we grow spiritually, we grow what? We grow in effectiveness and we grow in understanding. Wow, how cool is that? Love and tolerance is our code. So we're very accepting. I just wrote on the website about some people don't know me and they don't like me. Did you know that, Harold? They don't know me, but they don't like me.
Yeah.
Some people get to know me, then they don't like me. It's none of my business what you think of me because you think so little of me anyway. If not in stature, surely in time. That means most people aren't thinking about me. Sorry. So somebody said, well, you know, we like you. I like you, Joseph. You know, they're trying to protect my ego. And I says, let me tell you, you don't have to like me. Even if you don't like me, that doesn't stop me from loving you back. I don't have to be concerned at your perception of me. I know who I am. Good enough. So, I like to start the show off with, we use the big book. Oh, by the way, disclaimer, we are not Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not AA. We're not NA, Narcotics Anonymous. And we're not CA, Cocaine Anonymous. We're Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're more like Paranoids Anonymous. The problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. And if you're a member of Narcoleptics Anonymous, consider this a wake-up call. So we're not affiliated with any of the 12-step programs. Everybody works their own program. My agreement is, hey, I get that. Some people work steps, some people don't. You're staying sober, you're in maximum service to God and your fellows, who am I to tell you different? Then my question is the newcomer, the new man walking through the door, the new woman, girl walking through the door should learn what the basic understanding is, and then they can change it. Mark Twain said, first you learn the precepts and the understandings perfectly, and then you can change them at will. But they should learn what exactly the foundation of the program is, then they change it. Right, Harold, don't you think?
Absolutely. That's what worked for me. And my father was an atheist. So as far as understanding the Bible, I was miles away from that when I started, but I finally caught up, and I'm a student of the Bible now and a follower of Jesus Christ. So I really appreciate the 12-step program because it helped me bridge that gap. We weren't on speaking terms when I got there either. I was agnostic at first.
Yeah, and I think that's the way it's set up the way it is.
I think that's why.
All right.
And I'm glad it...
Yeah. Go ahead.
So before we hear from tonight's guest, are we going to do Chapter 5?
Yeah, I'd like to do that. And the point was, I was saying the disclaimer, is that I like to use the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The big book is the basic template of all 12-step recovery programs. There was no 12-step recovery program prior to the writing of the big book. So all those programs have derived from what's in this text. So I like to use the basic text because it is the original. And when you go to the original, you're going to get more of the original spiritual understandings. I like the big book, too, because on page 164, it says, this book is only meant to be suggestive. We know so little. More shall be disclosed to both you and to us if your own house is in order, and that's your spiritual house. It also says, see where religious people are right or wrong or anyone else. Those are statements of humility. We don't know it all. We're open. If you're able to stay sober in a different way and you have a joyous and productive life, hey, good for you. We have no corner on the market of recovery or sobriety, but we have found in the long term this has been the most effective out of all the programs. It's helped the greatest number of people for the longest period of time. And this is Chapter 5 of How It Works. We hear this in meetings, probably every meeting you'll ever go to, you're going to hear this, recovery meeting. And the reason why, and early and after about 5 years of recovery, I asked my sponsor, you know, I've heard this thing a gazillion times. Why don't we have to hear it every time? You know, I want more time so I can talk. So he says, look, Joseph, this isn't for you. This is for the new man. He says, as long as it remains all about you, you have a lot more work to do. And this is how it works from Chapter 5, page 58. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They have seemed to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what are we like now. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go. Absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it's too much for us, but there's one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all those persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapters of the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would.
He were
and
sought.
Would if he were sought. Yes, thank you. Well, now that's enough out of me, at least for a few minutes anyway. Dale, are you there? This is our guest for tonight, Dale Garrett. You there,
hey, how
Dale?
You doing? Yeah, I'm here.
Good. Good.
Hi,
well,
Dale.
Yeah, if you would, Dale, tell us like what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and what keeps you in maximum service to God and your fellows.
Okay, sure will. All right, first off, hello, how y'all doing? My name's Dale Garrett. I'm 53 years old. For about 35 years, I'd been involved with the meth trade. For about 15 years of that, I was actually, involved with making meth. Now, for years, I would hear about the horror stories of how meth labs would blow up and kill someone or either leave them severely injured. But I'd always say, that's not going to happen.
Let's back up just a little bit. When was the first time you did drugs or alcohol? Drugs were you doing? Did you do alcohol too or just?
No, when I was a teenager, I drank some and all.
Yeah.
And I went to the military when I was 17. And from 17 to 20, I drank while I was in the military. And then I quit. And I haven't touched alcohol since.
Alcohol really wasn't your thing. You really, alcohol was no big deal.
Did you drink a lot or no?
No, you just quit when you...
Not really. I didn't like getting sick. So it was a complete turnoff for me. So I had no desire for the alcohol thing. I smoked pot, as a teenager and all. And
Was pot your deal? I mean, you like pot? You like pot?
Yeah, I like pot, that was the first drug I used. Right after I got out of the military, was in the 80s, that's when the cocaine started first hitting the United States and all. And I tried it a little bit, and it was okay, no big deal on that. But then, crack cocaine finally made its way around, and that really grabbed me real bad. And for 10 years...
So how old were you at this time? So how long were you in the military?
I was in the military for 3 years. I was in the
3 Navy. 3 years. Well,
yeah. Yeah,
okay. You volunteered? Oh, in the Navy.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I volunteered.
Isn't it a four-year hitch?
No, it was
a four-year hitch or no?
It was three-year hitch.
A three-year hitch, okay.
Yeah, back then we had...
So you got in no trouble for drinking or drugging in the military?
No troubles in the military for that and all. Got out and everything. And
how old were you when you got out?
I was 20. Just
okay.
turned 20 because
right.
I had, yes, 17, 19. Yeah, I had 20 years old when I got out. And like I said, I just started experimenting.
And where did you live? Where did you live? Where was your...
Florida. Florida. I've basically, you know, lived Florida most of my life. But once I got out of the military, I started traveling around a lot. I've traveled about all the way around the world. After I got out of the military, I went and spent a couple of years over in Africa. I've been down in Central America and Honduras and Belize and all. Spent a few years down there messing around. But that's a whole different story.
So you're back in Florida now. You're in Florida.
Yeah.
And somebody introduced you. Now, you were doing coke, but coke really didn't ring your bell, right?
Yeah, it really didn't ring my bell. One of my birthdays, my cousin come over, and we're going to celebrate. And he said, you know, well, let's go, you know, down there to the hood and get some pot to smoke. Went down there. Nobody had no pot, and some guy said he had some hard, you know. And we asked, what is this, you know? And he said, well, it's cocaine. So we were like, okay. So we took it home, and it was a big old rock, you know. And we said, okay. So we crushed it up, and we snorted it. We didn't know what it was.
That's funny.
That was my first experience with crack cocaine.
You know why it's a rock, because you smoke it.
I sadly found out.
Yeah,
later.
At that time when I was growing up, what they did was they called it freebasing, and you would take cocaine and you would boil it up and put baking soda
and then create
the rock, and then you would have a rock. And so it took a lot of effort to get the rock. So it sounds funny about you taking the rock and chopping it up and then snorting it, you know, like, all right, so, okay, so you
sad,
snorted,
sad
you
say,
snorted
all
that crack.
And I learned all that, and then once I found out that you did smoke it, for 10 years, it literally destroyed my life. During this time, I had my own auto glass business. I owned a house, had, like I said, my own business, several trucks for the business and everything. I literally gave everything away for this drug. During this time, I admitted myself to rehab three different occasions. And each time that I admitted myself to the rehabs, I walked out because I wasn't ready. Okay, you know, I thought I was ready to get clean, but I wasn't ready. I tried my best to stay there. The longest I made it was 6 months. The very first rehab I went to was to the veterans. It was only like, you know, 3 weeks. It was basically like detox. It wasn't really a rehab. But 28 days. Yeah, so that's just detox. So that don't count as far as I'm concerned. But the first actual rehab I went to was a place called Dunklin Memorial. And it's down in the swamps down in Okeechobee. And it's down like a long 14-mile dirt road in the middle of the swamps, one way in, one way out. And the first time I went there, I made it for 6 months. It's a year long program, and it's faith based and all, and it's a very, very good program. It's self sufficient. They got their own cattle ranch, their own farm, everything, and they got a big pallet shop where they have big logs brought in. The sawmill where they take it down, logs down, and make pallets and sell them. In the mornings, you go through classes and all, learn about God and all this sort of good stuff. Then in the afternoons, you work. And like I said, I made 6 months.
Now, did they do 12 steps while you're learning about God? Are they doing 12-step recovery and work
No. This program does not do 12 steps. Okay, they actually call it a regeneration program, okay, and they are strictly God-based, okay? They teach you to live your life it's strictly, you can overcome your addiction through God. God can take this away from you, period, okay? You don't need to rely on nothing but God, okay? If you put your trust totally into God, okay, and live your life for God and be obedient to God and stay in God's word, He will take that desire from you, okay? And you will not.
You know,
I've heard
that before. Now, you familiar? Dr. Bob was a religious man. He had the love of Jesus.
Oh, yeah.
He was a deacon in his church. He read the scriptures every day, but still was not able to attain and maintain any type of kind of sobriety.
Right.
So why would you think that all of a sudden there would be a change?
Okay. I mean, some people it works with, some people it don't. Like I said, I went through this program. I made it 6 months through it, okay? While I was in the program, I was really into it, and I really, really, really thought, you know, it was going to work. Then when 6 months hit, I found out that this ain't going to work for me. Now, they'll bring you in there, okay, give you a ride in.
They will
not give you a ride out. So I had to walk 14 miles down this dirt road to the swamps.
Oh, brother.
And that's
you
a long
me.
Walk, 14 miles to the swamps.
Yeah, well, with alligators on both sides, I would imagine.
Yeah.
You probably had a couple panthers floating around, too. Oh, look, we have another guy coming down the road. It's lunch.
Yeah. There you go. Well, anyway, you know, I made it for about, I guess, 3-4 months out there on the streets and thinking everything, you know, I was doing good and everything, but like any old crackhead to do, you know, first chance, you know, someone threw a rock at me, I was right back into it again, and hot and heavy, and I realized, look, this ain't going to do it. You know, I know that I was going to die if I kept on. Let me ask you this.
Now, the program, you had the love of Jesus, you get back out, and you walk down the road, and now for a while you're staying sober. You going to church, and are you working in the religious program, or you're not? You are.
No.
What are you doing?
I started going back to church and everything like I was supposed to do, and I started getting involved in church and everything. But like I said, first time that someone, you know, come around me and everything, had some dope with them, hey, you want to get high? You know, like I said, like any crackhead, yeah sure, you know. And I took a hit, and that was it. And then it was on again. And you know, within a couple weeks' time, I was smoking more than I was the first time. And you know, I knew that this ain't gonna work. So there I went. I hoped and prayed that they were gonna take me back again. So I went back to Dunklin Memorial again. And I asked, basically begging and pleading them, will y'all please take me back? You know, I know I screwed up. I shouldn't have left. Please take me back in here. You know, I need help. Now, they told me, now, first time I went there and the second time I went there, they said, you know, they told me, you know, God's brought you here for a reason, okay? He's got plans for you. Now, this time when I got there, the intake guy said, you know, why don't you stop running? You know God's brought you here for a reason. All right, just stop running. So I went ahead and got in there. I made it 2 weeks this time. And I don't know, I still wasn't ready. And, there I go, walking down that road again. Only thing, this time, when I'm walking down the road, there's these alligators looking at me. And it was like I imagine
they let you go the first time. They can't believe that you were. They were
going
to let you go the second time.
It was like they were looking at me, licking their chops, like, "Yeah, we remember you."
We let you go the first time, but we're thinking hard now. We're thinking.
Yeah. So, but I got through there, and I got home and everything, and I said, that's it. I'm gonna kick this by myself one way or another. And about that time, I got introduced to methamphetamine. And it's bad to say this in a way, and good to say this in a way, but methamphetamine helped me get crack cocaine. Now that is all that's doing is trading one drug for another. True, okay?
Sure.
But it did. Take the crack cocaine away from me. All right, I quit from the moment I used methamphetamine. I never ever again used crack cocaine. It was gone. It took it away. But methamphetamine is And I'll tell you right now, methamphetamine is the devil's drug. It is the most evilest thing on this planet Earth. And I will go to my grave stating that.
Oh, yeah. Well, Harold knows. They've done CAT scans with people doing meth, and it literally boils the brain cells.
It does more than boils the brain cells. It eats holes into your brain, okay? It will actually eat holes into your brain. And now after years of use, there will be holes ate into your brain. Now after you quit, it takes once you quit using methamphetamine, it takes anywhere from 18 to 24 months for your system to get all of it out of you, okay? Now, system...
As you're using meth, it also robs the body of calcium, so
yes.
The teeth crack and they fall out.
Oh, yeah. Some people... Now, luckily, for some reason, my teeth are fine. They never had no problem. But your brain, like I said, it has some holes in it. Some of your brain will grow back, and a lot of it will grow back now. But some places, them holes will always be there, and some parts of your brain will not come back, and you will lose functions of some parts of it. But if in given time, you will get most of your brain functions back. But anyway, like
right,
I said, now get back on to, like I was saying, for about 15 years, I started, cooking meth.
It's fairly easy, isn't it? I saw that the TV show Breaking Bad.
The most stupidest. That is the most stupidest thing they ever put on TV, because all they were doing is glamorizing it, and that was a really stupid move on whoever decided to put that on TV. Is all I got to say. All right, that just exploded. It's a mess epidemic, if you ask me.
You think it made it worse, huh?
That really made it worse. Yes, that really made it worse. Okay, they don't. I mean, what they put out there on TV showing and all, that's bunk. Okay, they don't really show you how to make it and all. But I've made meth every way possible known to man how to make it, and there's a lot of ways to make it. All right, but. The reason I even started making it is because I got tired of buying it. Right? It's too expensive to pay people to make it.
No, I understand. I was at that area in a different drug, but it was like, okay, well, if I could start making some, then I can get high for free.
Exactly. And, like I said, for 15 years I was making dope. And over those years, I would hear horror stories of people that were blown up in the meth labs, caught on fire, got killed, permanently scarred and everything. And, I'd watch these documentaries on TV about it and all, and I'd be sitting there and say, that's never going to happen to me, because I'm too careful. I'm careful. I watch what I'm doing. I'm too careful. That's never going to happen to me. That's just like the person that sees the car wreck, up there. It's never going to happen.
Right, right.
I'm always watching.
You're smarter than that.
Smarter than that. And for 15 years, everything's hunky-dory, okay? Everything until it finally happened.
You're making pretty good money, too, aren't you? You're pulling in a lot of money?
Actually, I didn't do it for money.
That's part of the deal, though, whether you're doing it for money or not, and money's coming in.
Yeah, like I said, I didn't do it for money. I did it for my own personal use. I smoked a lot of dope. Okay, I'd go through anywhere from an eight ball to a quarter ounce a week, and that's only for my own personal use. And every now and then I'd sell some, but it was very rare. I was basically doing it just for my own personal use.
Oh, okay.
And,
let's put a different lilt on it. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I had no reason to sell it, I stayed to myself. I had friends that come over. If they want to get high, they got high with me, whatever, but I wasn't doing it to sell it. I was doing it because I didn't like having to buy it.
15 years, that's a long time. Okay.
It is.
Amazing.
I held good jobs. I was an industrial sandblaster painter. I worked all throughout the world going to jobs, and I held very high-paying jobs, and, traveled all over the place, so, money was no problem. That's why, I didn't have to do it for money. I mean, I made big bucks, and when the jobs I had, they supplied me houses and everything else, so, I had no problem with none of that. But like I said, on December 14th, 2011, I was living up in Iowa at the time, and I was in a basement, down in a basement by myself. I was making up a batch of meth for Christmas holidays, and sitting there, and all of a sudden, just boom, it blew up on me. And from the waist up, I was set completely on fire. And I had one of the ingredients that you use in making meth is Coleman camp fuel. And it takes 2 cups full of it. So I had 2 cups of Coleman camp fuel burning on me. And with no way to put it out. No one else is in that house with me but me. Now I'm downstairs in the basement. Now, by all rights and means, I should have died that night. I mean, there's no way that fire should have went out. But within 7 seconds, that fire went out. And the only reason, and I'll go to my grave saying this and leaving it, the only reason that fire went out was God put that fire out that night. And he put it out for a reason. He put that fire out because he seen that he could use me to reach other addicts that are still caught up in this addiction, and I can help them get away from this drug. And that's what he's using me to do now. And
so that was your – I had one question, though. That's interesting about the 7 seconds in hell. Now, you were traveling. When you were traveling, were you making meth like you're in different countries and you were able to pull it together in different places or no?
When I was in different countries, I just had to do without.
Oh, okay. It would seem like you'd have to have a fairly secure location and access to certain equipment and all that. And it smells, too, right? Is there a lot of smell? Isn't that what they –
That's something else, too. A lot of people think that, it smells this, it smells that. If you know what you're doing, you can hide the smells, okay? I mean, you can be sitting in my living room, okay? And I can go in my bathroom, and I can sit there and make a batch of dope, and you'll never even know I was in there making dope.
Really? See, I didn't know. The assumption is that a lot of the labs, they can't, like, they'll do it in, like, mobile homes and things.
Yeah.
And somebody will smell because of the ammonia. It makes a real bad odor. But so they don't know what they're doing. That's why it makes that much smell.
Right? It's not that they don't know what they're doing. It's they don't care. They're in such a hurry to get high, they don't care. Okay. That's the problem. They don't care, so they're just sitting there, knocking it off fast as they can so they can get high.
I see. So that, yeah, so they're not being
if,
careful.
I was careful enough. I knew what I was doing. I took my time and everything. I watched what I was doing. I paid attention to every step that I did. So that when I did it, you could be sitting right next to me and not even know that I was making dope because, the way I did it, there was virtually no smell, no nothing. I really spent extra effort in making sure of that.
I see. Okay, so now you had the 7 seconds in hell, and then, of course, you touched by the hand of God, right, because you figured this was we call it the jumping off point, a moment of clarity. Some people call it grace. All of a sudden, this fire goes out, and you know that the hand of God had touched you, and you had a mission now. Now, what did you do after that? Okay, now
like
you're clean. You go to the hospital?
Well, like I said, basically I died that night is the way I look at it because, I was completely on fire. I should not have lived through it. I basically died that night. And when I woke up in the hospital, all bandaged up and everything. And I laid there, and I turned. That's when when I was like 13, I gave my life to God back then. But that was like when I was a kid and all this here. So things happened and all. But laying in that hospital, I just looked at myself and, you know, I told God, look, I'm tired of this. You know, my life, the way I'm going, I'm going to destroy myself. I said, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I just killed myself. I no longer, you know, I'm useless. I belong to you now. You know, I turn my life over to you. Whatever you want to do with me, do it. Use me however you want to use, because I belong to you. So at that moment, I turned my whole life over to him. And from that moment on, you know, I belong to God. And that's how I, you know, that's how I see it now. I now belong to him. I have no life now, you know. It's, I belong to him. That's all it is.
All right, had you done any rehab? Did you work any of the steps? Or
After I got out of the hospital, I got sentenced to 10 years prison. Okay, I was sentenced to 10 years.
What happened? Well, wait, we missed that. Now you're on fire. Now you're in prison. Went to the cops.
I was on fire. Okay, I went to the hospital. Okay, I'm in the hospital, and I spent a couple months in the hospital getting skin grafts and all. And they finally, after several months, they finally put a warrant out for me, and say that I was a fugitive from Iowa, because I went from the hospitals in Iowa down here to Florida. Because they let me go from the Iowa hospital and said they were done with me up there, and I flew home back here to Tampa and was immediately put back into the hospitals here, because, you know, they took one look at me and said, no, man, these grafts ain't even holding. So they immediately had to do more skin grafts on me down here, and I was in the hospital here for a month. And the day they took the last staple out on me, they came in there and said I was a fugitive from Iowa. So they hooked me up and took me to jail.
So they arrested you in Iowa?
No, they arrested me down here in Tampa, Florida.
Okay, well, you're a fugitive from what, though?
From
Iowa.
You're
a fugitive. So there's, yeah, right. Okay, what happened in Iowa that made you a fugitive?
That's where I was making the meth.
I know, but so you were arrested. There was a warrant out for your arrest.
They didn't. Well, like I said, that's just what I'm trying to tell you. Okay, I blew myself up in Iowa. I spent a month in
hospital.
Yeah,
I got that. But there's usually
Iowa.
Police. There's a court system involved with few. With
it. Okay. All right. Well, here's the deal. I blew myself up in Iowa. Okay.
Uh huh. Yeah.
Well, I blew myself up and all. I called my son, because he lived 20 miles away. He came there to the house and to help me. And I told him, you know, hey, help me get rid of all the stuff, because, you know, I knew the cops were going to show up there and all. And I said, get rid of it. He takes it and puts it behind the barn. I meant for him to get and throw it in the river down the street by us. Ambulance comes, the sheriff's comes, and all this stuff. They throw me in the ambulance, take me off. As soon as they get rid of me, the cops notice the fire behind the barn. Because after I left, the fire reignited in the bag. So they go out there and put the bag out and find all the evidence. Okay.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, you know, I spent a month there in the hospital in Iowa getting skin grafts.
So then what, they indicted you in Iowa, right? You were indicted?
Well, that's what I'm trying to explain now. I spent a whole month there in the hospital in Iowa. And they released me from the hospital. And then they said, you need to come here for outpatient. 2 weeks in a hotel there in Iowa, every day going to the hospital, getting seen by the doctors. And then they said, there's nothing else we can do for you. Now, during this whole time I'm there, no cops, nobody ever came and seen me. So we said, all right, you know, well, we can't just keep on like this. So we flew back here to Tampa.
So you had no idea that you were indicted?
I had no idea I had a warrant or nothing. I had no clue, no nothing. So I immediately went to the hospital here, was put in the hospital here, and they start doing more skin grafts. I'm in the hospital here for 2 months. All right. The day they pull the very last staple out, they come in and say, you have a warrant for your arrest for being a fugitive from Iowa for manufacturing meth. Okay. Just out of the blue. They took them that long to finally put a warrant out for me. So then they...
Did they try you in absentia?
What's that?
That sounds awful. Did they try you in absentia? did they have a trial and you weren't there? What happened?
No, they'd done nothing. They had done nothing yet, okay? I mean, this is the first we'd heard of or anything. So anyway, they expedited me back up to Iowa, where I went to court and tried and everything. And I had a public defender because I couldn't afford a lawyer. At first they were going to sentence me to 25 years. And,
whoa.
And the public defender got them to let me plead out to 10 years. And then we were going to go to sentencing. By the time we got to sentencing, the public defender had talked to the prosecutor and talked the prosecutor, because the extent of my arms and my damages, had actually talked the prosecutor into agreeing to let me come back to Florida on probation. Okay? And the prosecutor had actually agreed to let me come home on probation. And he said, and when I came into the courtroom, he said, "Good, this is good news. All you got to do is have $100 to pay the interstate compact. You're going home for probation." And we get in front of the judge says, you're going away for 10 years. He didn't care what the prosecutor said. So, you know, I got sentenced for 10 years, which, you know, the way I look at it, you know, I believe, when you do something, there's consequences. Good, bad, good consequences,
sure.
Bad consequences. Whatever you do,
yeah. You
know this. So you better be prepared for whatever it is, the good or the bad. You better be prepared. So, you know, I had no one to blame but myself. So, you know, I had to take what it came. So, you know, I took it. Now from this point on, before I go any further, you're going to hear me say a lot of I's, okay? And from this point on, now when I say these I's, I want to be clear that these I's about me, none of these I's would have ever happened without God, okay? And all these I's don't mean nothing. All these eyes go to God. God gets the glory for every one of these, okay? Because I would not even be here had it not been for God saving me. So he gets the glory for each and every one of these eyes that you hear from me from this point on, okay?
I hear that.
Okay, I just want to make that clear, so because there is a lot of eyes that's going to come out of me from here on out. But I just want to make that point clear. So because I will never ever take credit for any of this, because, you know.
All right, so you're in jail now, right? You're in jail. You're in jail.
I'm in prison.
You're in prison.
Okay. I'm in prison. Okay. I'm serving a 10-year sentence. Up there in Iowa, you're serving a 10-year sentence. Before you can even get out on parole, you have to serve at least 2 years before you can even be considered to get into their drug treatment program. And once you complete their drug treatment program, then they will consider you for parole. All right?
Yes.
I'm there 8 months.
Uh-huh.
They call me in front there. Now, all right, like I said, when I'm in the hospital, I turn my life over to God. I told him, I'm yours, use me however you want. And from that point on, I have been very obedient to God, and I mean very obedient. I do everything he asks me, but I don't wait till he says jump or anything. I'm there, I do everything for him. I am very, very obedient to my God in every which way, shape, form, and fashion. 8 months into my prison sentence, I'm called up front. I'm told you're being released on parole. And not only are you being released on parole, but we're interstate compacting you back to Florida.
Wow.
8 months into the prison sentence. And they don't let you ever even do that.
What were you doing for God? Were you helping other guys? Were you telling your story? Were you ministering to them? What were you doing?
What was I doing? While I was in jail or in prison, I was going to my, you know, weekly NA meetings in there, right? I was doing 12 steps in there, in jail, or prison. I should call it jail, prison, whichever. I was going to NA meetings there. I read my Bible like I was supposed to. I stayed in his word. Just regular things, you know. Just talked to him. Just stayed in his word. And that was it. And
were you helping other fellas in there? Were you ministering to anybody or no?
Well, yeah, I would talk to other people about God and all. Now, while I was laying in the hospital, I looked at my arms and I told God, when I looked at my arms, I told him I want you to leave my arms just the way they are, scarred. I don't want these scars to be removed because I want to use these as a tool. And I also asked him, how am I going to reach other people? How am I going to reach other addicts to help them? And he put it on my heart to write a book. He said, write something, you know, put it into words what's happened to you. This is what you're going to use as a tool to reach other people. So those 8 months that I was in the hospital, in the prison, I started just writing down everything that happened to me. And, you know, during that time, you know, I started writing it down, and for some reason, you know, the number 7 always, I mean, for every day, you know, I had no title for my book, but every day, the number 7 would always come up. The number 7 would always come up for some reason. I just didn't know why. And I always, when I would think about, you know, what had happened to me, I would think back at when I was on fire, and looking through them flames, and all I could think about was God gave me a view of what hell looks like. He's actually gave me a view of what, if I don't change my ways, this is what I'm fixing to spend eternity in. And then that 7 kept popping up in front of me. And that's where I came up with the title for my book, My 7 Seconds in Hell.
Ah,
and
okay.
It's the complete, and then it's the, and actually, now actually see, I have 2 books. My 7 Seconds in Hell, that's my testimony, okay? It's available on Kindle,
right,
but that's just my testimony. And that's just testimony. Now, the actual book is the tool, and the reason I wanted a book, it's a tool that I can reach out, that I can reach out to people who are in prisons that they can actually have in their hands, because I'm not allowed in prison until I'm off of parole, and then 2 years after that, I'm not allowed to even go into a prison to speak to anyone.
Yes.
Okay, that's one of the rules. So this is a tool I can use to get in there to them, okay, that they can have in their hands. And there's so many people
idea
in there that's in there for the same reason, that, you know, they come out and, you know, right back into this same mess. But in this book, they can read what's happened to me. They can see how how I came back through it. They can see there is hope, you know, after this, and, you know, through God, they can find a better life. There's pictures in this book showing the actual damage that's done to me, and it can give them hope to see that there is a better life. Now,
great idea. I actually go into the prisons and jails and teach,
right,
and so maybe I'll have to take a copy of your book in there.
Yeah. Well, actually, since January, now online through Amazon, every 90 days, I'm allowed to give the book away, the online copy. I'm allowed to give it away for 5 days every 90 days. And since January, I've gave away over 5,000 copies of the online issue. Now,
that's the Kindle version?
Yeah, that's the Kindle version. Now, the paperback version. Now the paperback version. Excuse me. Now I'm disabled, okay? Because of the spire, I'm completely disabled. I can't work no more. All right, and one of the conditions of my parole was I have to live at my mom's house, and she doesn't work either. But my book through Amazon costs $10. Now, if I buy ten books, I get two books free. I have a younger sister. She's been grateful enough. She helps me every month. She buys 10 books for me, so that gives me 2 extra books. since January, I've actually gave away 500 books, actual books. And these 500
cool.
books to people that online, that their moms, dads, addicts, they've wrote me or left messages saying, look, I really like your book, or I need your book for my son or my daughter, but I can't afford it. I send them a book. People write, say, my son or daughter's in prison. I'd really like for them to have this book. I send them the book. I've sent so many books into prisons, it's unbelievable. But I have actually gave
what's
away
for of your, what's the name of the book?
It's called My 7 Seconds in Hell, The Complete Story.
Oh, there it is. I see it.
Yeah. And it's available through Amazon.
Well, that's great. So so we can get it through Amazon, and then there's the Kindle. And what else keeps you in maximum service? So you write and you have a ministry going at all? Or
yeah,
is it
the book? Actually, I'm involved. Like I said, since I'm disabled and everything, I'm involved online with recovery groups. At the present time, I'm involved with about 75 different online recovery groups. I'm an administrator of 8 of them. I begin to notice out of all these recovery groups that there's no faith-based 12-step programs online, and you know that kind of really bothered me because you know, like I said, I base my soul recovery on you know God's word. Now there's AA, there's NA, and all these other recovery groups. And I'll say this right out front: I have no problem with you know AA or NA. Everyone has what works for them, and I have no problems with that. But my recovery is solely based on God's word. From
yes,
the Bible.
Well, celebrate is faith based, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yes. Celebrate recovery is based.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. But still, I mean, celebrate recovery is good, okay. But I wanted something that was solely straight from the Bible. Everything. I wanted something that was going to be every step comes straight from the Bible, from His Word. So it got me to want to start my own online 12-step program. So that's what I ended up doing. I started a 12-step recovery program. It's called God's Way Online 12-Step Recovery. And it's totally faith-based. Everything from the program comes from the Bible, okay? I mean, the steps come from the Bible. The passages, I do scriptures from it. We also I have people keep a journal from it, so that you know, I teach them how to journal and everything, so they learn how to. Once they start learning how to journal, I'm sure if you know anything about journaling, it helps you get more and closer in contact with God, and after
yes.
a while, you understand what journaling does, and it'll really blow you away how God will speak to you through your journaling.
Oh,
and,
cool.
Yeah, that's.
And
what's
so,
the website again?
It's called God's Way. Online 12-step recovery.
It's a Facebook site.
Yeah, all these sites are through Facebook, okay?
You got to be on Facebook, Harold. It's a Facebook deal.
Oh, it's a Facebook thing? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Have you ever connected up with Dick B? He does faith-based recovery based on the original...
I haven't heard of him.
Oh, yeah, you should put him in there, Dick B. He's got a really good program.
Dick B?
It's Dick B as in boy.
Yeah, okay. Well, why don't you send me a message, because you've got my email. You know,
I'll send you the link to his, and
yeah,
I think you'll find
cool.
a lot of really good information. It was the original.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, he does the original AA where it was was basically a faith-based, and then slowly it evolved more into less God. You know, I did a piece on Rum Radio, and it was like AA threatens to fire God, demands more benefits and less participation.
Okay. All right, cool.
But but what we found is that my understanding is not so much that AA is trying to elbow God out of the rooms. Society as a whole is elbowing God out. And AA has become a reflection of that society it finds itself in. So one of the girls on one of the chat sites from England, she said, you know, I think Joseph's onto something. She says, I don't go to church. None of my family goes to church. She says, I don't know anybody that goes to church.
Right.
And the original AA was all about spirituality. It was about God as, you know, like in the center. You know, Bill had that phenomenal spiritual experience, and you hear people in the rooms going, well, a light bulb came on. I says, and the one thing, they'll go by Bill W. for everything, but when it comes to his profound spiritual experience, people will dismiss that in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Well, you know what you just said something there about, you know, the lady had said that, you know, she doesn't go to church, and none of her family went to church. You know, a church isn't nothing but four walls, okay? A church is nothing but four walls.
Well, you got to put people in there. Otherwise, if the people ain't in there, it's just a building.
Yes.
People make a church.
Make
a church.
Exactly. People in there makes it. It's just really, you know, it's Christ. Christ is about, you know, spiritual. That's spirituality, okay? That's where I get it from.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's great.
So we can
get your book through Amazon. You want to give us that information again?
Yeah, it's my 7 Seconds in Hell, the complete story. You can go to Amazon and just type my name in there, Dale Garrett. Either way, it'll come up.
Yeah, I just bought it. The Kindle version is only $3.
Yeah.
That's great.
Oh, that's great. And you went to Amazon to get it, Harold?
Yep. It's real easy.
Oh, okay.
My 7 Seconds in Hell, complete version.
The complete story.
Oh, cool. Okay.
So,
all right, do you have any last words?
It's on my
I'm already.
Yeah, I got two other sites here also.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay, all right. Now myself and another friend of mine, his name's Todd McGill. He lives in South Carolina. Now, we've started a page called Stop America's Meth Epidemic. Now, on this site, what we do is we attempt to get laws passed to make it harder for people to obtain the ingredients to make meth. All right?
Okay.
And it's a tedious thing we're doing here, but it's working. And I've also started a page called Meth Lab Busters. Now, on this site, what we do is we educate the public about what you can do and how to tell what a meth lab looks like, how it smells, or what to look for. Because, you know, most people don't realize that the shed right next door to you could be a meth lab. All right? And on this site, I got videos and all kinds of things that shows you what to look for, and all this stuff to know if there's a meth lab in your neighborhood, and then who to contact and everything once you realize that there's one in your neighborhood. This meth lab could be right next door to you, and you got kids running around, and I mean it could kill your kids, you know, and you don't even know it's there. But I'm educating people on how to be able to tell that it's there, so you know you can. I mean, just by watching these videos and stuff that I've got on this site, you'll be able to know. I mean, there's no way that you won't be able to tell once you watch these videos on this site.
Oh, that's a great idea.
But it's a very good site.
Stop America's Meth Epidemic. I found that one. And the other one is called
Meth Lab Busters.
Meth Lab Busters.
Yes.
What a great idea.
Well, good. Hopefully our listeners will get a drift on that, you know, and go there. We, you know, like we're not affiliated, so we do NA and CA. So
We have a lot of the NA. We interviewed one time Kathy Kinnan Lindert, who's her dad, Jimmy Kay, is the one who developed NA. And she wrote the story, and she told about how Bill W., she met Bill W. when she was like 6 years old, and how Bill W., through AA, would help fund NA many times. He said if it wasn't for the funding of AA, NA wouldn't be in existence today. A lot of the narcotics folks don't lose. But you got to remember one thing, though. Alcohol kills five times as many people as all the other drugs combined. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Now, one last thing, and this will wrap me up on this. Now, throughout these 75 recovery sites I work with, every day I have people seeking treatment. So I've made it my mission to help people. And as of this moment, I deal with three different treatment centers, and I send people to recovery to treatment centers every day, about once a week. I'd say 3 to 5 people a week I send to treatment centers. So if you ever hear of anyone that needs treatment, you can refer them to me on my site.
Okay.
And I help get them into treatment. I've got one treatment center that's worldwide. If they don't have money, I can get them in there, even if they can't afford it, for men or women. So that's no problem. If you got mental issues, there's one of the centers that they deal not only with drug issues but also with mental issues. So they're here to help, and money is no option for it. So please send them my way if they do need help.
Oh, that's great.
Terrific.
Well, thank you so much, Dale. Yeah, thank you for your service. I like to say, when we're in the service of our fellow beings, are we not in the service of our God? And when we're in that service and in that moment, are we not divorced from self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity? And in that service and in that moment, is that not when we make our conscious contact with our Creator, who lives from moment to moment, eternity to eternity, life everlasting? The magic words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead.
Amen, brother.
So thank you so much for your time. It's been very informative, huh, Harold?
Yes, this was a great program. Dale, I really appreciate your wonderful approach, and thank God for you. And I really appreciate the things you shared tonight. They've helped me, and I know they're going to help a lot of our listeners. Thanks for being on.
I really appreciate y'all allowing me to be on your show. I really enjoyed speaking with y'all tonight.
And
well,
God
thank
bless you.
All right, God bless you too, brothers.
Thank you. In closing, I like to say Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi. 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 200,000 and 300,000 hits to the website. So if you're looking for sponsorship information, good, solid sponsorship information, remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.